Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm wondering whether the Law Society, this is, as not saying that I'm saying so many words, but to remove the word and the words and who receives or holds money or property belonging to any person. So it's a good reading. An attorney who practices with uncounted sums that must be in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate. Previous point. The words
and who receives or holds money or property belonging to any person yet.
Those words are repeated in sub two.
Well no. Look, I think for one if they come out.
For one they come out. Consequential amendments dealing with advocates across, particularly here, but across the board.
Employed by the agent from receiving money from the client. she lived with it when the keys were there.
Well, center whether it's a total session of all the costs, so it's a reasonable fee. I'm suggesting, and I think I should do more than that to find out properly how it works. And so I think we should speak with the clinics, speak to the board, just get a little bit more clarity and just give a formal response to the committee.
It seems to me that there seems to be good grounds for the specific exclusion of INJ, what are they called? 7 and 8, section clause 34, 7 and 8.
34,
7 and 8 entities. That's 34 is the forms of legal practice, 7 is the non-profit juristic entity, 8 is the law clinics. There seems to be a good basis for excluding them, which they're not at the moment, from the having to have a Fidelis Fund certificate. So I think we must do his investigations, and but that's the way we seem to be heading, unless Mr. Dyer comes up with anything to the contrary.
You see, it states the information. me a state versus organ of state.
Reference to chapter 9 institutions.
Yeah. But it's not, I mean, what the clause is saying, no legal effect is to keep any money, the full-time employee, whatever we're talking about, may receive any money or property belonging to any other person. You are working for, you're necessarily working for the public protector. The resolution of the dispute is paid for the money for the person who's going to be dealing with. Terms of this clause, you're not allowed to receive it or keep the money. Or go to the guest house of the public protector. So I would say that corruption or temptation.
Should we not relook at the whole ethos of the transactions, irrespective whether it's state or otherwise? Should we not be looking generally that if you receive monies in any form, even if it's acting on behalf of the client, in whatever circumstance, legal clinic, legal aid, essay, whatever, if monies are coming in for the purposes of general housekeeping and protection, should we not just have a blanket thing over a trust account? So you're held accountable, you can investigate, say there's a complaint, and just assume that.
Now you're going against what was being discussed under legal aid. Legal aid, they are receiving money, they don't need a trust account, either because the money is in a law clinics. You can receive from anybody is in the course and scope of your employment, and you can't receive anything on the side. So if you're working as a public protector, you can't charge a additional fee. You can't say, okay, I'll help you with your dispute, you pay me extra $1,000, and I'll just ask you. That's why you get the right commission. That's why you get the right commission on the cost.
Would apply to the gender commission. Include, would it be relevant? I could see it being relevant, particularly for the gender commission and human rights commission, possibly to a little extent. But it protects a bit your auditor general and. Definition clause in for purposes of clause 84.
that clause, it truly only applies to legal practitioners, not legal advisors. But legal advisors are not covered by this Act. Bill.
B, I think, is the compulsory business course that attorneys are required to undergo before starting up in practice. So the Legal Society is suggesting that a clause of that nature be included in the bill, and the department has no objection to that. It probably will be a good idea. That 13B, I think, was included in the Attorneys Act. This committee had was privy to that amendment in the Attorneys Act a few years ago.
Training procedures. council determines the training procedures, surely they will determine that you need legal practice management support. So this was a transitional arrangement, really, bringing it in. Is it not going to be, it's not expressly covered, but then there's a lot of that's not expressly covered under the training. We've left the training open to the, whatever the bodies are concerned.
I think the need to emphasize the entrenchment of a mandatory practice management course in the bill is well placed in the sense that whilst if we just leave the training and they get this vocational training, the point that is made by the fund is that it must be mandatory that when you apply for it, that you would have completed this course. And there are some exceptions if you've covered certain courses, and the Act talks to that. But what it does, it says to you, you can't just open up a trust account. You're going to have passed this course, because from our own investigations, from our own risk management, we find that this particular area is one of those areas that has caused high risk among attorneys that are not stealing trust accounts, but because they can't manage their affairs of business management and understand the trust accounting mechanism and simply leave it to an accountant, you get into trouble later on. And this is a protection mechanism for newly established attorneys, giving them a good chance of succeeding administratively. And in that context, it was introduced as mandatory, and the amendment came into the Attorneys Act. The Attorneys Act is going to be revealed, try this bill. And I think that there should be sufficient reason to include it specifically under Fidelity Fund Issue Certificate, despite what Mr. Jeffrey is saying, will be covered in the normal course of tax accounting. But I think that's the point they seek to make. Look, I don't know what the point is of providing for, I mean, we provided for training requirements, I think this should be done by regulation or whatever. Why we're highlighting, because remember this applies, Mr. Dyer, to all attorneys, not a specific category of attorney. It is every attorney who for the first time is required to apply for Fidelity Fund Certificate. So it's not as if Fidelity says that this category of attorney, this type of practice is going to require more work, you must do it, everyone. I suppose there's no harm, and I suppose the advantage is that if you have this separate course called practice, legal practice management, then at least you've got a course that you can identify for advocates to do who want to take the Fidelity Fund certificates, because you would expect the practice management material to be covered under the attorney's training, but you wouldn't expect it to be under the advocates to the same extent. So I suppose there's an advantage there, and therefore it should be included.
Agreed, Mr. Swart?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, Chair, under 85 as well, UNISA wants, where the attorneys, I mean, I suppose it's the bad risk insurers. Is that not covered elsewhere?
They couldn't that be dealt with by the council in consultation with the board. I'm just looking at clause 85.3. The council must, in consultation with the board, determine the amount of the contribution for the ensuing year, if any. So then that determination can't be dealt with there.
Should there be provision that your risk, that everybody doesn't pay the same amount of money? If you're a bad risk for the Fidelity Fund, they should be entitled to charge you more, so that elements of discrimination are brought in. And we need to specify that. So it's not necessarily the risk profile, but it is basically your risk, whether you have caused the fund to have to pay out money in the past, that can increase your profile. That's a factor that can be looked at in determining a separate amount. As with people getting insurance,
the cassette thing is...
Well, you can have on the council website.
Website.
You need to possess the material if you have it on the... Because difficulty is going to be, if you have a thing like this, I mean, the advocates then their chambers, and the office of the advocates is where the funds go up, because in the school, secondary school area, one must go there, and they lose control of it. Now, are you going to have to go knocking on advocates towards the table? Where you've been told somebody has, you go and don't want up and they don't have one, they know it's the fall on the train broke and have to take it off.
I've repeatedly over the last 50 years been to medical practitioners who have this arrangement when I get sick, and I see all of them, specialists, the doctors in the chambers, they handsomely display. We must look at it, but I haven't been to a single practice.
The problem is that you make a rule to say this must be done, and then it doesn't get done, what do you do?
Alright, we'll slow down. Yeah, that's the problem, Mr. Dyer. It's a good intent, but we'll slow down.
When you get your script or whatever from your doctor, put the practice number at the top. Maybe they can think about something like that. Do you have a practice number? It just fits it.
And then if you don't say it, you get it.
So if you don't, if you take money, so there will be a penalty.
The wiring thing, yeah, that's the point. I wouldn't legislate. The wiring thing breaks, okay, and it breaks the glass, and then you have to take it into the photo framing shop, and then you're not displaying it. You forgot to pick it up from the photo framing shop because you were busy, and you know, yeah.
Advocates and consuls come with their certificates and it's not work out at all. They even wanted us to put in their roles, we refused because it will cost tedious. People won't be able to be represented because the child, the advocate or the attendant, they have the certificate at home. And people actually receive money for the steps of the court. And people don't know if they've got qualified certificates. They are not always in the office. And today that was only electronic. And it was on the account of the advocate or whatever. It's the people that have the people. I don't know what that is. They may put it for advert purposes, but that's not me. We have to pay money and attend. And something, if the purpose is to say that people must look at it when they give payment, it won't achieve that purpose.
Does away with that. No, clearly not. Yes. So you made reference to clause 64. C clause 64.
Five as well.
hand over to the fund. And we need to look at that. I think the submission should be flagged, because firstly we need to decide, should any interest be paid to the fund at all? Secondly, if so, what is the capping? And they talk about a 5% of the interest. I know there have been concerns. I remember reading newspaper reports about clients complaining about the interest they received. They were expecting far more from a 2 million rand amount that was deposited in a trust account for a property. And after 6 months, they received very little interest. That's not to say that the attorney took any interest. It was purely the manner that the money was invested. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if the attorney invested cautiously and didn't speculate. Depends where you put the money. But in that case, I think that there was less than 1% interest was generated on the funds. And there was a lot of, it was in the newspapers. But it's the discretion of the attorney where they invested those funds. So I don't have a particular objection to a percentage of that interest going through to the funds. If it's 5%, it's minimal amounts you're looking at then. How one then is going to formulate that, and I think it's just an issue to be flagged again to come back to. It will change the existing position. But if I'm reading this correctly, Mr. Dye, it seems that the proposal that the Fidelity Fund is thinking about is contained in the bill at the moment. It's not something that is coming at a later stage.
Yes, and there is a contradiction. I think it's in the previous areas that it points out that 65, 685B and 641G contradict each other. The department agrees with that. The bill in clause 86, maybe we should go to 86, deals with your conventional map, put it that way, your conventional trust account. And that's very similar to the wording in section 78. I really am going to rely on Mr. Dyer's assistance here. Your trust account practice, that's your subsection 3, clause 86(3), is similar to section 78 to trust accounts that we have now. A trust account may have its own accord invest in a separate trust savings account or other interest-bearing account any money which is not immediately required for that purpose. It was that clause 4 trust account. This is what we sort of loosely refer to as an investment account. And that's your section 78 capital A trust account. At present, your section 78.1 and 78.2, the interest that's earned on those trust accounts in terms of the attorney's act, the interest gets paid over to the fund. The interest on your section 78 to capital A trust account, the interest doesn't get paid over to the fund, but goes back to the client. We are replicating that in clause 86. The fund is now saying 5. Mm-hmm. Interest accrued on money deposited in terms of this section must, in the case of money deposited in terms of 2 and 3, paid over to the fund. And in terms of subsection 4, that's your investment trust account, be paid over to the person referred to in that subsection. So that is really a perpetuation of the existing arrangement in terms of section 78 of the Attorneys Act. What the Fidelity Fund is saying now is that a portion of the interest earned on the clause 86 account, your investment account, should also go over to the fund. And it would seem as if the NSSA supports, if you have a look at the next comment on page 61 of our document, the NSSA would support a proposal that part of the interest accruing on the investor funds be paid over to the fund. So I think that what the fund wants and what the bill doesn't say is a percentage of the investment account interest to go over to the fund, and the NSSA seems to agree in principle with that, although the book doesn't say that, and then the that amount go over
and
to
you kept by the funds.
What is the motivation for that? Because you've got sub two and sub three, those investments that spent to the funds. They interest you. Now you the client say specifically you want an investment under sub five, sub four. And why then should a portion of that go to the fund? That's the desirability that we need to discuss. Because there's been quite a bit of concern about where some clients went, and they probably have to be advised at some stage the different investments under the previous dispensation 78 and told this investment will go, all the interest will go to the fund, this one. And why would you, I'm trying to understand the rationale, why would you as a client agree to what is previously a 78 earlier investment where your interest goes straight to the fund and not to you? And why would you now want, from a consumer perspective, to go, the fund says, yes, we're covering you. You're not giving us the interest, we're still covering you. And that's not wrong. We want 5%.
They're taking the risk.
The risk, yeah.
Yes. So, Mr. Jeffrey?
Attorney to hold the purchase price of the house in trust. The attorney runs off with the money, and the Fidelity Fund will cover me. But that money that's been invested, I get all the interest currently. And the argument then is that because I'm getting free insurance thrown in, I should pay for that insurance. And it makes sense. I mean, there should be a small percentage.
Just need to recall, we discussed this yesterday, because I pointed out the link between the purpose of the fund and the trust accounts. What if we decide there, is the fund going to cover those interests?
It's pleasing when you invest money purely for investment purposes. Other, when you have a conveyancing and you give money off and that goes into a trust account, that must be covered.
I think from a public
protection point of view, it makes sense that the public does have coverage for that. I mean, those are the bulk of your large amounts of money. And therefore, if it is covered, then there should be some kind of payment for the Law Society, for the fund carrying the risk. And so I think it's fine.
I would suggest that we refer to something in the regulations here, because you don't put a percentage here that could change. So in terms of the council's regulations, when you determine what the percentage is. The percentage of that interest that goes to the fund, do you want in legislation to that 5%? Or should one rather say elsewhere?
Yeah, the Law Society proposal is limited to 5%, and I think an upper cap is reasonable, because you don't want, if you put in legislation, then somewhere along the line somebody could say, hey, we're short of cash, let's make it 50% of the interest comes to us.
That's right.
It's provided the portion is limited to it would be a maximum of 5% of the interest.
Well, yes. There's a contradiction that the Law Society pointed out, and we've noted that, and we'll fix it. Okay. Any tips for us? We've dealt with that. Interesting. inspection of attorney's trust account and the LSHA isn't that comfortable with the situation.
Right.
The way it is, it's a concomitant power. Let them both have the opportunity of inspecting.
Okay.
Then I think 87.4A, which is unclaimed, the Fidelity Fund wants, but how long must it be unclaimed for? I mean, the department is agreeing to inserting the words after unknown to
a year.
87.4A unknown or which is unclaimed. Do we need to specify how long it's unclaimed for?
The fund says a year, Mr. Chairman.
Unclaimed for a period of at least a year.
Is that okay? Alright. 875. LSSA wants this provision to be expanded so that the inspection does not necessarily only relate to inspection of accounting matters, but to investigate other allegations of improper conduct. The department is not clear what other improper conduct the fund could have an interest in. It might be rather something to provide for under the discipline clauses.
I think so.
And then move on to 89. All right. So we're leaving sub five out, eh? So what are we going to do? We could do that. Okay. 89. They take it.
I venture to add the justification to include other documents is when you are looking at the trust account documentation, it's just limits just the ledger, maybe the receipts. But if you don't add it to the file, that might basically have information that is damning. You look at it in isolation. And I think that's the reason that they want to be able to do that, because the accounting records is limited to you know, book document article relating to trust account practice. So what is that? It's the ledger, it's the receipt, that sort of thing. And it's arguably a position you could take two ways. One, you could say, well, you've got a problem with unprofessional conduct, there's a procedure, follow it. And get do it through if there's a complaint. You can only do it as a complaint. This is the right on accounts and documentation for the fund or the council without a complaint.
Yes.
To go in and have a look at that, because their business relates to the trust account, the handling of the trust account. My point is this: in doing that, it is so limited it might be so narrow that they might have to at least look at the file relating to it.
Okay. Right. How say you? That sounds very interesting. Some people call that a fishing expedition. But it's what they have to do, isn't it?
I think the question is just widening out. I would have thought relating to trust accounts would include the actual file with the instructions and things like that. Maybe it's just a clarifying.
May we move on to the next one, which is 89, clause 89. SSA is saying that only the council or regional council, if that power is delegated to it, should have the power to apply to court to prohibit a person from operating his or her trust account, and the bill gives this power to the board as well. In respect of a trust account, and as it reads in the bill at the moment, the master plays a role in the appointment of a, says that if any attorney dies or for whatever reason, the master has an application made by the council board or any person having an interest in the trust account appoints a curator bonus. Now the NSSA is saying that experience states that the master refuses to make appointment under section 78(9) of the attorney's act on the grounds that regulations referred to in section 81 have never been promulgated, and NSSA is suggesting a process that works well in practice now, and that the clause be amended to incorporate the procedure which is currently adopted by the societies, namely that the rights and duties of the curator be incorporated in the court order, with the master's office not being involved. And this seems to be working well in practice. I'm not sure why the master plays a role there.
A lot of concerns about the master's appointments in insolvencies, and that whole issue is a murky area around that. And as much as we appreciate the work that the master does, sometimes this must be done very quickly to appoint the curator to avoid funds being stolen and removed. So I don't have any objection to that proposal.
Definition, right?
Start of 91. Any attorney practicing on his or her own account was a partner or member of a trust practice. So
now are we including bachelor sisters? Surely what is meant there is the reference to the 84 one people. Why reinvent the wheel and create confusion? It's the attorneys who are meant to have attorneys and advocates who are meant to have trust fund, fidelity fund certificates. It applies to them, so they cross-reference it to that section for certain.
Are we okay with that, Mr. Bassett? All right. Sub 3. Judicial management. We've got to bring it in line with the new companies.
The trust account practice is secret, made liquid or liquidated. Master mail application or whatever we're doing with master. The master's coming up in June.
Except clause to judicial management in terms of the new company act, I think we just had to bring it in line with whatever is in there.
All right, fair enough. That's okay.
Not too sure how we want to deal with clause 91. What we are basically saying is that this clause is similar to section 78, 10 to 13 of the Attorneys Act. And the approval and to deal with the approval of opportunity to discuss that document with my colleagues. So I'm not sure how you'd like to deal with this and possibly the rules which is 495.
Then I think the issue for me is those matters where the council, as representing the profession, has a vested interest. I mean, those matters that could interfere with the independence of the profession, we need to look at quite carefully. But those matters where the profession has an interest in not transforming, the minister needs to play a more dominant role, because the council is representing the profession is not going to be capable of it was unlikely to be capable of coming up with anything transformatory. So when it comes to issues of forms of legal practice, maybe they'll be okay with that, but anything where it might undermine the monopoly, you know, one needs to be careful of that. I think the issue of having skimmed through the thing or looked through the thing, the law school thing about students being allowed to appear in court is, I think, out, as you say the department doesn't support it. I agree with that. And then, unfortunately, in the absence of Ms. Smuts, the Bar Council, I mean, we're not having two chambers.
I think generally what Mr. Jeffries is saying about the regulations, one needs to look at the whole issue of independence, one also needs to look at transformation, but I don't know how much further we're going to get with finalising, to give guidance to the department today. There's a lot of issues here. But should we not at least just go through what the submissions are saying on the regulation? I think that's what you do.
Yeah, I was commenting on some. I do think
here we need to have maybe this afternoon, and when the DA component is back, we do need to have, if some members want a discussion on the two-chamber model, we need to discuss that, because I think what I'm expecting to see after this process is a redrafted bill with amendments that we can then start going through to consider whether we accept, reject, or want to reword an amendment.
Yeah.
So I think if there are people who want to have an argument, and possibly Ms. Smuts had indicated that, for two chambers under the council, then we need to have that today when she's back. But otherwise, as far as the regulations, I don't have I don't have any other comments. I just wanted to note that point when it comes to what Ms. Batchett is going to do, that in terms of different procedures may follow for how different regulations are made. It's not necessarily one size fits all, but it's all definitely NF. They would need to be under separate section where there's a requirement of a consultation with the board. I think it's appropriate that it's an after consultation, not an in consultation with the board, so that they make an input but they don't have a veto. You know, the rendering of community service, for example, which, for example, that would need council, then Parliament can be used to break that deadlock. Yeah.
So, your guidance, what we're going to suggest is paragraphs J, K, L, and possibly M be removed from those. I don't know whether those are issues that require regulations and be taken over to the Ombud, the provisions dealing with the Ombud, because J deals with them. With the manner in which a notice of application for review must be lodged with the Ombud, K deals with the form of a summons issued by the Ombud. L deals with the manner of service of a summons issued by the Ombud. Do those really belong under regulations here?
Yeah, they may not be here, but I don't think those can be left up to the Ombud. I mean, I'm going on the self-interest aspect. The Ombud may want as the least onerous as possible procedures to issue a summons and to serve a summons. But it's in the interest of the public that our requirements met. So I can't, don't think it can be left up to the Ombud on their own to determine how they're going to serve summons. Because, Chair, you know, the Ombud serves the summons and the complaint is against claims, I never got it. And because the regulations are so loose, the Ombud sending the summons in ordinary mail was down, so the Ombud is compliant, but in fact it could have been registered post, whatever. But yeah, I think different categories belong, that's what I'm saying, belong in different areas, but I think, can the department look at the question of interest and not trusting a body to have sole, they must be able to make an input, but to have sole discretion around the procedure followed over something that they may have an interest, and definitely the Ombud would have an interest in making life easier for themselves as much as possible, which may be in conflict with public interest.
Okay, we also agree that pupils should receive some form of remuneration.
Yes, I mean, we do. I don't know where that was quite an earlier discussion, and it maybe needs to be elsewhere, but I think the issue is that the Bar Council, I think, is seriously at fault for not having addressed this issue. And if you leave it to the profession, it's unlikely to get addressed. And the point is basically that the minister's powers as far as the payment of pupils, the dispensation for the payment of pupils, is something that needs to be provided for. Obviously, that payment is coming from the profession itself, but that would be, I think, in the category of the onus is beyond the minister. If you leave the onus with the council, it won't happen. It was unlikely to happen. And if there's a dispute, it comes to Parliament.
Okay. Where should it be? The department says in the regulations.
The regulations, obviously, but in that category of some of the regulations, maybe minister makes the regulations after the council has asked him or her. This would be a regulation where the initiative cannot rest to the council, so there would be different categories. And then I think it should be cross-referenced to an earlier section relating to the training. I think, I don't know if you've put it in there, but there should be something in the training.
Likewise for the candidate attorneys, because I know there's reference here to legal practitioners. There was a discussion at some stage as to whether we should widen it to include candidate legal attorneys. But going through the regulations, we don't specifically talk about the remuneration for candidate attorneys, so people and pupils.
Okay.
You see, the difference, though, is candidate attorneys work for a firm, one-person firm or more, or law system, legal aid or whatever. Because the advocates will remain as single people, I think that the amount that I would have thought a standard amount should be set for pupils, whereas it's more difficult to set a standard amount for candidate attorneys. You're lucky enough to get articles with a big firm, they'll pay you more because they can afford to. And you get a bit of training because it's multi-practice, etc., and you get sent to different departments, different sections within that firm.
not the what do you call the person who takes a pupil? The principal, sorry. It shouldn't be the principal who pays the pupil. That should be coming, as I think is the case in Britain. I mean, what we were told with Britain is it's £1,000 a month, which is paid by the council, I think. Sorry, by the chamber, okay. But it's I think those differences between candidate attorneys and pupils need to be looked at. Candidate attorneys are paid for by the person who the principal. Whereas the pupils, although they're working for a particular principal, the principal shouldn't be the one who's paying them.
Mr. Dyer also raised back then the idea that some of the funding would come from the CETA training fund.
Yeah.
So that also goes in the regulation.
Yeah.
Okay. Fine. And that is applies to both pupils and candidates.
We can't specify, but I think my concern is that the current dispensation is that candidate attorneys get paid by the people they're doing their articles for.
Sure.
Pupils do not. And if you look at the British dispensation, it is not the principal who's paying them, it is the council.
Yeah.
So there's more of an obligation to find money for that, because it's not coming from the principal.
The issue that Mr. Darwin asked for quality that it's whether it will be proper in regulations or so to set the standards for articles, because I know that and that should be discussed, because then you may be closing the door to small firms or small companies take articles in the unmet legislative standard. But I think it's by and large working, because they get some form of payment. It's only people age that has got no mechanisms. Must just not be caught us not to throw in this array the articleship in this process. To be very unfortunate. It's the people age that is the problem.
Can one say that there should be one amount and for pupils across the country, as in England? One could possibly do that if the funds are coming from CETA, but if it's the bodies themselves that need to fund that, then it could be, as you have with article clerks, your article clerk in a smaller town would not earn the same as an article clerk in the city, if one presumes that is the case. I don't know what the answer is, but I would presume that a pupil advocate in Mafeking, whether it should be the same as a pupil advocate in Johannesburg, and possibly that should, but that's just to open the debate, you know. Word. If it's a minimal amount, I'm just trying to equate that. But article clerks, if you have, would there be a disparity? I don't know. Would there be a similar salary if you are employed by a one-man firm or a five-man firm or a big firm? Is it similar across the board? So then should this principle not be the same for advocates? But I think there's a distinction. It all depends where the funds are coming from and the fact that pupils are not paid anything at the moment. I think that's the big difference.
Okay. Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I'm following on from Mr. Scorsana's point that the candidate attorneys are being paid, and maybe, I'm sure there's lots of room for improvement, but the system is working. We don't want to wait in there and mess things up. And as far as I understand the dispensation, I don't know if there are guidelines. If not, I think it should be, but they should only be guidelines. But because the firms taking on the candidate attorneys are paying, they determine the amount dependent on what they can afford. And unfortunately, the quality of your training as a candidate attorney would very much differ according to which firm you go to. If you go to one of these huge firms, I think what they do is to give people a bunch of training. You rotate between departments. Single person practice in a small town, you're going to do everything, and it's going to be limited. And so we can look at the council making guidelines for the payment of candidates' attorneys, but I don't think we should go much beyond that. Okay? We can get some money to subsidize them from the CETA's time, but because it's been working with them being paid before, I don't know why the CETA's need to pay for the candidates' attorneys. The problem, though, is they're not being paid, and that is a huge problem. And that's where I think the issue of looking at the CETA money must come from. But I think whilst there's a spread and the cost of living may be higher in Mafeking or in Cape Town or Johannesburg than in Mafeking or Grahamstown, the number of places that there will be pupils is very limited. It will be where there is a bar, and that will be where there's a high court. And there are not so many high courts around the country. The judges are all being paid the same. So if you happen to be the judge of the Northwest High Court, you will be paid the same money as a judge of the Gauteng High Court. So there is that aspect. And then I suppose the issue is, well, where do you draw the line? Like Grahamstown, you may be able to walk to work because the place is very small, which is more difficult in Johannesburg. But now Pietermaritzburg, it's sort of between Grahamstown and Joburg and so on. I'm told the cost of living in Cape Town is very expensive for food and stuff like that. Now, do you factor that in? It all becomes a bit complicated. I'm not against it, but I'm just saying, I think the principle I'm making is following what Mr. Scorsano said. Let's be careful about tampering too much with the political clerks, the candidates' attorneys. I would have put it sufficient for the council to look at guidelines relating to the payment. But where we have to create a new dispensation is for the payment of pupils.
Okay. Please bear in mind that any regulation made under this subsection comes to Parliament and must be approved, according to the bill.
But it may depend on the nature of that, what is there. Some of it may not need to do. Some of it we definitely would have to.
Okay. As you proposed, Mr. Jeffrey, the question of the two-chamber model we will need to debate. 95.1M, Mr. Bassett, level of competence. We're on 95, eh?
Yes, 95 deals with a whole range of rules.
Yes.
Which the council may make or must make with the circumstances that require. 95.1M, the level of competence to be achieved for admission and enrollment as a legal practitioner. But as I say, so that needs be clarified, and surely that will be clarified in the rules when they are being made. Yes?
Forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same position should be followed with the council.
they do amendments and they publish those for comments, and then you've got another whole long process, and then you decide to adopt those interested amendments in the game, and you then have to publish again, and you might have to publish two or three or four times. So I agree with 2B as it is. I disagree with your side and the department and the great comments there.
Mr. Dyer and then Mr. Ford.
Can I ask, sir, would any of these, is it possible that any of the consequential amendments might affect the public?
Amendments to the rules, you mean? Okay.
I think the if you look at the way we deal with public comments here, is that if there is an entirely new matter that as a result of the input that comes up that was in no way canvassed, I think we did have one earlier, and we basically said, look, we can't go into too much detail, I can't remember what it was now, that would need to be in new legislation. You need to distinguish between amendments to the rules arising from the comment received, and as a result of something that somebody raises in a comment that you hadn't even, an issue that you hadn't even thought about, that needs to be a new rule. And that's the process that we follow, and that's the process that I think the council should follow. I don't know if that's making sense. It's not spelled out that we have to do that, but we've just, I think, inherently done it, I think, because we would be afraid of being subject to review if we legislate on an entirely... Where an area where we've made a new provision, so, for example, the provision relating to... the diary briefing is already in the bill, we're just making it easier, but where it comes to, which isn't in the bill, the payment of pupils. It's an issue that has been canvassed in the public hearings. I feel confident that we don't have to resubject that for public comment. But there was an area, now I can't remember what it was, last week that we were discussing where it was point, sorry? I think the paralegals here it hasn't been subject to sufficient comment. We cannot actually go too far with that. I was at the senior council aspect as well, maybe. But yeah, so I think that it's played by ear, but otherwise if one may not be able to spread it out a little bit better. But the intention would be that as long as it's amendments to the rules rather than new rules would come out as a lot of comment.
Is this what you want to come in?
Understand the issue of amendments to the rules and 2B. Honourable Jeffrey said 2B should stay as it is. Now that is altering the draft rules as a result of any comments. But what about amendments to the rules? To A, make a new rule. If you amend the rules, I'm trying to find the process for that. Because the Lord Christ's concern relates to any amendment to the rules. Should be published for comment.
Yeah.
I think that should be done. But not, I agree with you, that as a result of comments. So I think that we just need to get clarity on that.
I think, sorry, I maybe misunderstood the Law Society then, that there should be provision, 91 is about making the rules. There should then be provision as to where the rules are amended, which will happen over the course of time, that the same procedure must be followed in two. It may be inherent because you're now making a new rule by amending it, but I think it needs to be spelled out.
That brings us to the end of Chapter 9, and Chapter 10 is the transitional provisions.
begin with chapter 10.
I don't know how you want me to deal with it. I mean, the race institution of race relations is something that's been debated. Independence Association of
Yes, we and also then we flag, can we also flag this?
Which one?
The transitional council, because surely when we have the discussion it will be linked.
I don't know.
My worry is that I suppose the only issue on the council is
advocates, attorneys, parity, which Dean is still only keen on, but really when you look at the figures, I don't know how you can sustain that argument. My difficulty with this is, yes, the DA are not here, but was this not all worked out
with the profession?
I mean, the one thing is going to be, what is the Black Lawyers Association? Does it need to be defined as the legal certainty? What is NADEL? What is the Independence Advocates Association? I suppose it's just that, but I think everybody is pretty clear what they are, but they're not statutory bodies. But I suppose that's covered. I mean, I don't have a problem with coming back to it, but
So I don't think there was agreement with the profession on the composition of the transitional council.
So I think it's we're going to have to make that decision at the end of the day. So I do think it's an issue that needs to be discussed.
I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, Mr. Skosana. It might be good for Mr. Skosana to say something in this regard before he leaves. I don't know whether there's anything on the composition
of the transitional council.
Principles would be.
Why don't we wait until the DA is here?
Then Mr. Skosana is not going to be here. But okay, we can leave it. Unless Mr. Skosana has got anything he wants to say, but I think that they've. You know, obviously, those people, I see the Bar Council don't want advocates of transformation there. You know, there's those sort of things, and people who are not there want. Owners of Dell don't want it.
Oh, okay.
But that's the problem, and I think a bigger body than inclusivity rather than
of reference 97.
You're getting general comments like from UNITA, this provision has tons of problems and disputes that could not be resolved thus far. Should be increased. I don't think we need to discuss that.
Just on that point, how can they
DLA and RDL are aligned with the ruling party. How can they, I mean, that's total rubbish. How can the Transitional Council recommend that the representation of RDL and DLA should be increased statutory?
Yes, it's statutory.
Has not been negotiated with them. This is coming from the mere perspective to provide inclusivity. Because when we engaged with the profession, they came within their organized structures. So we engaged as if we come with a composite structure as well, we with advocates, welcomers, last GCB. So advocates for trans men ever came within that fold. Not that it was a direct engagement and negotiation with each of them.
Voluntary associations. Now, my understanding is that voluntary associations can still exist under the dispensation of the bill. So, presumably, two cannot apply to the disbandment of voluntary associations. What two is applying to is the statutory bodies, who will no longer exist because the law is being repealed under the schedule. So should two not specify that? And the statutory bodies, as I understand it, are the four provincial law societies only. Okay, it does not affect, the Law Society of South Africa, which is not a statutory body, and it does not affect the DCB or any of the other bodies. So should we not, now I don't know who's got the assets, the Law Society or the provincial law societies? But presumably then, this too should relate to the provincial law societies only, and as should three, transfer it's two and three are linked. And then what happens to the Law Society of South Africa and the General Bar Council will have to be up to them. I don't think we can't prohibit them from existing. So should two must be reached agreement, not with the attorneys and advocates professions, but with the four law societies.
To the four
statutory law societies. And maybe there can be maybe we're under a definition or whatever, but it's statutory. We're not statutory law societies for the voluntary sons. Do they exist? Advocates, attorneys, general law, and then if you think of Transcar would have been legislating from 75. Oh, there. But no, but you see, that's not the same thing. That's a South African act. All three of them, Hofsky, Boff and Vender, are South African acts from 1964. Unless they were assigned, I suppose they could have been assigned to the relevant newly independent homeland.
They were too, yeah.
Okay, but they don't relate to advocates, they don't relate to attorneys. But can you reflect on that? Then presumably
Thank you. this stops to you.
I think the issue is that the council is, the dispensation as I understand it is this, the council has 36 months to sort all this out. Within that 36 months, they must take, in the first 2 years, the first 24 months, they must resolve these issues. If they can't resolve it in the 2 years, then the minister can extend it probably for another 12 months. So hopefully at the end of the 2 years they discover we cannot resolve these issues, so we go to arbitration. We've got a year for the arbitration to run its course. And hopefully that would be, I would assume that would be sufficient. Maybe just to point out as far as, I mean, you know, the power in the new body is going to be with the National Council. And what goes to the regional councils is delegated, so the provincial law societies wanting to keep their assets is not viable from that point of view.
Now, thank you very much for your indulgence. We didn't have a choice. We didn't have to be aware. But now, because we've come in at exactly this importance clause, I would like a little summary of the reasons why we're making a transitional council. I mean, I think it's some of the answers, but I would like a little summary. Secondly, it is now understood between us that you cannot constitutionally close down voluntary associations. Therefore, the bar councils continue, and whatever they do with their own representative functions is their own business. Whatever regulation now goes to the council, but there might even be room for some self-regulation of some description provided, not in conflict, etc. So that leaves the law society that you're trying to understand you that are created by statute. Therefore, we can shut them down by statute, no direct anything. But the power created by statute, as I said, the Honourable Jeffrey argued that. And therefore, we can make some new arrangement. What I'm looking for in the answer as to why do we need a transitional? A transitional and a permanent as part of the decision. I mean, it's a weird scenario. Why the transitional? Is it because we get old or the old Pakistan and etc. No. Can I have a little bit of argument even though I come in now late?
The crux of the bill, which the minister had to go to the cabinet and approved, to change the structure of how the business process. Because then, when we change the profession at the initial phase, it was going to be very cumbersome to await for a national council to come in and do those transitions and draft the rules for the new body and do the admission and continue with the ongoing run of the meet. One, the first thing we need to get a more democratic institution to take the foot forward while we transform the bigger one. We protect that need within the current structures, mainly because one advocate is not regulated. And with the other way that we could institutional otherwise have enjoyed upon the GCB to take some of the aspects moving forward. There's no way we could have brought pupils to repeat to them. There would have nothing to the advocate at all. There was no structures. In terms of which it must take us to what a country. So and the debate around the room had gone on for too long, and it was found until that voluntary association will be compared with the implemented mandate of a legislation. So the only vehicle was the CLC. Second point, that although there were arrangements within the attendance profession, then we had to get a method of amalgamating the different different provincial law societies. So they come into one. The law society calls itself a different organization, and we engage with them, and they told us that look, why is that we've been taking resolutions extremely badly, because we don't have any social assistance. In fact, we don't have any outside the agreed consensus amongst ourselves. We don't have any special basis for us to do what we do. We want to get out of office. Have been prolonged because we've been waiting for this process. And we met with the profession. They also agreed in the consultation that we would have to get a body picked up to end state. If we were to wait for the whole bill and the whole chapter to come into operation, it would have been very difficult to get started and to get the minister even to go to parliament with the bill, because if you look at the matter of central council, there were things which you could not agree on, especially the attempt to bring the federal national council, who is the how they get to meet 24,000 at least, how they come to 7,000, which is if we're going to start going out and put it into a paper, what is a certain point? Number one, legal structure. Two, the structure. And three, financial structure. Two, one, two, three. So that we can still move. Otherwise, we will not get moved. With any financial. So we as I said, we are still the transatlantic concept.
Thank you.
Now, just one last thing.
And obviously, 97.3 with the staff applies to them too as well only. So the GCB and the Law Society and all the other voluntary associations remain with their assets. I wanted to come back to you on an issue with that, but it was much too long.
Yes. Just Olson's last speech. There is reference to agreement which was arrived at between the bar and the sidebar, which then was not taken up in the last draft of the bill. Am I right in, and I heard reference somewhere else, which forgive me now, I can't remember where, that that agreement, which was not taken up in the bill, was in fact the two-chamber model. Is that correct or is it not correct? If not correct, what was Judge Chaskelson referring to? The agreement that had been reached, but which was not taken up in the bill.
Shoves all the land into to try and stop the new government getting control over it.
Yes, that was the intention.
That was the intention.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I hope that the Law Society of the Northern Province is not setting up some kind of trust to keep all their assets.
Yeah. You see, we've been silent on this, jumping at the bit, as it were, but all right. When you're ready, you can respond to this. What did you...
I'm just trying to understand the legal implications for voluntary association. A voluntary association is by its very nature voluntary, and it exists by nature of the contract between it and its members. So why would we need a clause here? They decide to themselves. They decide of themselves that they are no longer, they're going to disband. Their constitution will decide how that works and what happens with its assets and liabilities. How can you, in a statute, determine what will happen to them? From their side, they will, of their own accord, disband and say we want to join the council, but they're already members of the council.
Yeah, mine was more out of concern for, say, LSSA staff.
That obviously what happens to the LSSA and its assets and its staff is entirely up to them. But they said they did want to disband, and that's their decision. And they then wanted to try and find place for their staff in the new structure. Maybe it's not necessary to legislate on it, but I thought it would assist them by making a provision, a requirement that you know, that issue can be looked at, that special preference can be given to those staff. So that would be the special. I would be worried that if there's no provision, that the staff would be basically the same as anyone off the street in terms of getting employment in the new body. So it's from that point of view.
Wouldn't
that be against that legislation to give them preference like that? I mean, they should get preference by virtue of the fact that they have the relevant experience, so it would be, you know, they would qualify.
No, preference,
not right.
Not right. And what we dealt with the amendment of the labor, the Supreme Court's bill in respect of the labor court. The people who have served 14 years don't have had what they wanted. They must give them preference. And that's what all those things of experience, previous conduct, whatever, will be taken into account.
Only applies to statutory bodies. So what I'm saying is some kind of provision that other voluntary associations may request this. So it does, they mustn't be given, if the law society has lots of assets and they say, we're donating our assets to a care home, but we want you to take our staff, then I don't think there should be any preference given to those staff. But if the law society says, we'll forward our assets to the transitional council, and they, but in return, will you be nice to our staff and give them preference? I think that's fine. But I don't think that the staff should get any preference if the assets go to the cat's home.
It sounds like you're negotiating on behalf of the transitional council. But all right.
Those who have to continue, even though they may have been brought by Bulsa
appointments of members of the ANC, only members of the members that are going to participate in the performance and the success of his functions and of his government functions, can be in writing to any of his powers to his committee subject to their conditions, and then conclude agreement with any person. That's 2C. Conclude agreement with any person or organization for the performance of any particular act, or any particular work, or the agreement of any service for the purpose of following the object of CLC. We advise to keep it very open, not to be specific to discipline, and not to be specific to voluntarization, because we don't know what will happen tomorrow. CCP may not be there, but you can still appreciate an arrangement with the CRC and dedicate the function to people, to an individual, to person, to a committee with the CRC. So it requires a lot of realization. And we advise to keep it very open. It may not be answering the question of responsibility, but it was part of what we anticipated when we looked at the CRC.
Take over the DCB or any bar council's disciplinary matters. Those must run their course. You need to provide for the fact that they would need to run their course, I suppose. The council will deal with new matters involving advocates, disciplinary matters against advocates, right? DCB and the other bodies will have to complete their matters. What happens if they don't? Okay, then they may want the council to take over the matter, and I don't know if that is covered under 2. But anyway, first of all, I'm just talking about the council. There's nothing now. Okay, before that, okay, the law societies are being abolished, the provincial bodies, with the repeal of the statutes. This occurs at the law society level. Done at a provincial level. Now, surely those matters must be taken over by the Transitional Council. And that's not provided for. It's vague. So I'm a bit unclear with the thing. I thought the dispensation should have been that one, under terms of reference, that there should be a term of reference relating to discipline. Why can't the Transitional Council start dealing with disciplinary matters against advocates that keep with them from the date of the coming into effect of this Act? Because who else is going to be? Are they going to be unregulated for the 24, 36 months until the Council comes into effect? So that's number one. But once this Act comes into effect, surely then the Transitional Council can take on new cases relating to advocates. Surely also in the process, if a advocate's body wants to shut down and hand over the disciplinary proceedings, previous disciplinary proceedings, to the Transitional Council, it can if they want to, and there should be provision for that. Then the law societies, I think there needs to be expressed provision that those matters will be taken over by the Transitional Council. You know, so the Transitional Council and the new council will be dealing with old attorneys' matters, which they have inherited from the law societies, provincial law societies. Whereas the new council and the Transitional Council cannot deal with any old matters affecting advocates. They can only deal with new matters that happened after the commencement of this bill. And in fact, there needs to be some process of enabling those bodies, a transitional arrangement, to enable even the voluntary bodies to complete their matters. I suppose you can't, it's difficult to impose statutory requirements on them. But I think the whole provision relating to the disciplinary process is very vague. I'm not convinced that 2982 covers said, I think the differences between disciplining of advocates and disciplining of attorneys. And because disciplining of attorneys is statutory, that needs to be provided for.
Mr. Dyer?
The difficulty I have with the proposal is the following. The TLC is to set up structures, to make recommendations. It's got 2 years to do that. You can do it in 2 weeks. But it'll set up structures, it'll make recommendations in out consultation, all of those things. And if not, the minister will push them and get this thing done. The committees that are set up are not final committees. It's recommended as to what the final structure is going to look like. And my concern is that if you start introducing fresh matters, let's look at the advocates, if you introduce fresh matters into a temporary transitional structure that might change until it is finally approved, you create a problem. If you look at the provisions of the bill insofar as pending matters and the appropriate section dealing with the same is 115, I think what it says is that until the bill comes in on the date so to be promulgated, the existing structures dealing with the discipline must run its course. So that continues. The Law Society is clearly on with the discipline. Because they haven't been abolished, they'd be abolished on the date at which this comes into operation.
That's right.
So there's a hiatus, there's continuity in the interim of the TLC setting up its affairs and getting finality and making those recommendations. And so let's look at the date where it kicks in. It can transfer immediately because the structures have been formed and it's a handing over of power.
So it's smooth.
So the only other issue in my mind with regard to the advocate's profession is you've got no statutory regulation, but at that date that the bill kicks in, those committees are formed, and those matters will just get transferred into those structures, unless I'm looking at it too simplistically.
I understand then why the Transitional Council does not deal with disciplinary matters. However, I'm still worried about... Okay, we can deal with it when we get to 115, I think, pending proceedings, unless you want me to deal with it now.
So I thought, Mr. Jeffrey, honourable members, we should carry on with the process as we have done thus far and move... If we're done with 97, then move on to 98 and so on. And deal with all of these methodically.
Yeah.
We flag the issues we want to debate.
Can we not debate while Mr. Sosan is here, 96, which we relate to the proposition?
Well, it's 10 past,
the information.
10 past 12. As long as, remember, I've agreed he must leave when we decide, which we decide, I'm not sure, 1 o'clock or so.
Shouldn't we deal while he's here then, because I think he's got the knowledge of the negotiations.
All right, let's do that then. Who's going to come in?
Why do you have wonderful parity as between the two professions in 96 and in the final council, who have given the attorneys more?
All right.
Mr. Dyer throw his hand up in horror?
No, he's allowed to do that. It's not only Mr. Susanna that's going to answer. You don't want Mr. Dyer to answer.
I do.
Okay. No. Mrs. Schaefer?
Honourable members, is this. The TLC must be seen as a
inclusive process of the current formations. The TRC must be seen as an all-inclusive process of the current formations. So in all of its definitions, it enjoins all of the voluntary associations that exist in the length and breadth of the legal profession. And so the thinking was that it's a very important process to have everyone to be part of a final structure that is going to be defined into what is going to be a statutory regulatory framework. And the role of the voluntary associations are extremely important and not to be excluded because they're voluntary. And by a political dispensation to include on a proportional representation a forced marriage at the HSA between statutory NADEL and BLA was not coincidental. It was a negotiated political process that has overlapped its marriage and experienced its 20th anniversary 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the profession is crying out for this divorce. And that's the point about having all of the representations. And so also, when you talk about the GCB, you also talk about the other groupings, because as we've heard during the proceedings, there's always been a perception that the GCB carries the largest number of advocates. And of course, we all know that it's a perception that the majority of advocates fall outside that family. And so we've broken down what is the length and breadth of all the organizations that exist and said, be part of a negotiated process in which you have a vested interest. And then the numbers got defined in terms of the final structure. So I'm hoping to that extent, I'm satisfying Honourable Smut's question.
Just remember you've got Mrs. Schaefer's.
Point is either on the marriage. If this is the
why all those things were not themselves out in terms of how many of the other books in terms of code, in terms of latex, whatever. That's when we came to this point at the end of the day. Otherwise, it would be cumbersome.
So they've been dragged kicking and screaming into the new system. Excellent. Very much.
they are represented already on the legal side. Christian Lloyd's Association has been in existence for 20 years now. They are represented on the law side. So that's where they have their representation. They are also represented on the law side.
But if they're all represented, then shouldn't they just stick to the Law Society and not all those other groups that is already represented in the Law Society? Because the question is, on what basis do you determine that the Muslim Lawyers Association should not be part of here, and Christian Lawyers Association and whatever other groups, but the others, National Forum of Advocates, and all these other ones, are good enough to be included in this? My proposal would have then been that we say that it's only the legal practitioners in the Law Society, and then the GCB and stick to that. Otherwise, we would have to open it for everybody, even for my group that I will form tomorrow.
I'm just trying to see how I could have read it.
and how it can be worded. There is uncertainty, how it can be worded, that there's no uncertainty. And then I think the same would apply to the council as well, because I think the same terminology is used is in so many people nominated. I don't know what else you can do. It comprises the following members. Of the following members, 8 attorneys nominated by the Law Society.
Did you make any argument? That doesn't bother me.
No, he didn't.
Did
but
it
was
any reference to regulations?
Yeah, because he's who he is. And that's wrong. This is paper.
Well, first of all, the English is wrong. It's not comprising of, it's comprising, so that needs to be changed. Comprising of is wrong. But I would just say that if there is any room whatsoever that the minister has a say in who is appointed. I mean, essentially, as you quite clearly said, that the bodies nominate and the minister appoints those that are nominated by those bodies. So effectively, well, if that's not the case, then that's fine too. But there is absolutely no room whatsoever for any other interpretation. And the people who are appointed are the ones who serve on the body.
One is tempted to say he's guilty of what the MPs do. They don't read the bill. Some MPs. Thank you, Mrs. Schaefer. Certain MPs. Alright. Alright. Thank you.
Okay.
Where the difficulty lies.
Okay, so the JSC Parliament will nominate the people, the 6 members. So they get appointed to the JSC by the president. No, okay. We just check on that because if the procedure of the JSC on the advocacy is the association nominates people and they are then automatically there, then it's fine, we can keep the same thing. If they nominate it and then the president
concerns about the advocates for transformation already being represented. I mean, 50% of DCBs should not have separate representation. So they are opposed to Roman 5.
Maybe with this little time I think we'll speak on that before. But my thing is, I mean, clearly on the transition account, we've got to have parity. I don't regard
if you have 50% of the GCB being represented, then there is a very, then there is progress. I don't understand why Mr. Jim is saying it is a progressive movement with the GCB. that isn't coming from the GDB, that is coming from a progressive body, not the whole that's subject and already represented. So, I don't know how far one can take it, maybe one should just leave it as it is, because I implied in the presentation that they, Nadal, and DNA would have separate representation on the advocate side as well.
Advocates and people like the attorney.
I don't think I have to go into what was the initial conception that the UCP can handle that, but that will do whatever may not be from advocates and people.
It's fine as it is. It's Nadal making the objection, not the other people. The objection is noted.
GCB also objects to that.
Oh.
Advocates for transformation are represented on the GCB and should not have individual representation. Thank you.